Hi, my name is Lauren Templeton, and you are listening to Investing the Templeton Way. This podcast is for anyone interested in learning more about investing. In this podcast, I will be interviewing some of the greatest minds from the investment community and exploring topics ranging from international markets to behavioral finance. To learn more, please visit us at investingthetempletonway.com. The information presented in this podcast or available on the website is not intended as and shall not be construed as financial advice. This podcast is produced for entertainment value. Investing is inherently risky, and I encourage you to seek financial advice from a professional who is aware of the facts and circumstances of your individual situation. Thanks for listening. All right. Good morning and welcome everyone to the Investing the Templeton Way podcast. I'm your host, Lauren Templeton, and I have an exciting guest with me here today, Monsoon Pabrai. Monsoon is a graduate from UC Berkeley, and she's also the managing partner and director at Drew Investment Management. Monsoon is the daughter of a well-known investor, Monish Pabrai. She's one of my favorite people to bump into at conferences. And Monsoon, you are the second female to join my podcast, and you're definitely the youngest person I've had on the podcast. So welcome, Monsoon.
Thank you for having me. I'm excited to be here.
Yeah. So you've had a really interesting background in investing. Tell me about your childhood, your relationship with your father. And of course, we're going to ask you about your lunch with Warren Buffett.
Of course. Childhood was great. My dad and mom really were just a dad and mom to me. I mean, we're ethnically Indian. So they definitely throughout my whole childhood were expected good grades, would always get us tutors if we were struggling in a certain, you know, subject. And both my parents were actually involved heavily in my education all the way to going to college, but especially in elementary school. I mean, I think my mom had science and history, and I think my dad had math and writing. They would almost be like our at-home check-ins with them on specific subjects. And the investing part in my childhood would probably be when we went out to dinner as a family. If like my dad had found like a new investment, he might go over that thesis very simply with my sister and I. And what I really remember was we might be taking a flight somewhere and he would go through like Airbus and Boeing and the business models and how they compete with each other and how there's not too many other players. Same thing with Coke and Pepsi. We lived 15 minutes from Disneyland, so we went over Disney as a business too. And I think that's probably the more interesting part is the business models that were just kind of randomly brought up and discussed, probably age 8 or 9 onwards. And I think the first time I think my dad tried to get my sister and I to start thinking about investing was he asked us both, I was probably 8 and Momachi was 6 or 7. And he asked us to, he was going over a circle of competence, and he asked us in everywhere we spend our time with him and my mom and we go outside of the house, what is something that we think would be there in 3, 5, or 10 years? That's a tough question to ask a 8-year-old kid.
Yeah.
And I answered Target, and my younger sister answered Disney. And he just bought us 1 share each, framed it on a frame that said My First Stock. And it's still in our bedrooms since 2003. And Momachi actually beat me. Disney performed better. So that was just like kind of like a fun thing we've checked in on since we were really young.
Well, you know, I love that story because my dad also bought stocks for me and hung the stock certificates in my room. I think it was a very powerful teaching tool. And I love that your dad did that with you and that you still have that hanging somewhere.
Oh, yeah.
Mine are not because my parents have moved since I was a child, but that's such a great story. And did you enjoy these conversations with your dad, or were you annoyed with them, or you thought they were intriguing?
They were always cool. He's a good storyteller. So he made it very engaging for both of us. And it wasn't just him kind of telling us the thesis. He really walked us through, kind of had us do the math along with him, guess along with him. I think he's popular for saying, like, if you can't do the math on your hand or very quickly in your head, it's probably too complicated math. And both my sister and I are like pretty strong in mental math, so we were pretty much able to follow just very well. I think that framework of thinking I still use today. So I just like how simple he made it for us, and relevant.
And do you think he was encouraging you to eventually go into investing in finance, or was he just trying to educate you?
I think it was more education. I think the one thing that probably was encouraged in the home was entrepreneurship, not so much investing. But both my mom and him had started their own businesses, like a couple basically after they left college, and they're both trained engineers. I mean, my mom had an e-commerce business. She now runs a solar contracting business. And my dad had his software services business, and now he has his fund. And then all of them, you are responsible for your pay, everyone's pay, their rent, making, truly making revenue and being responsible for people. So I think that was probably a little bit more encouraged by both of them. But there definitely was no, hey, you should go into investing talk.
Well, it definitely sounds like entrepreneurship is in your blood. Now, I know that you were 12 when you had lunch with Warren Buffett. Will you please tell my listeners about your father purchasing this really well-known lunch and anything you can remember that's special about that day?
So he won the lunch 2007, and my mom's sister and I were at the UCI library refreshing the page frantically while he's in his office increasing the bid. And I remember we were screaming in the library when he won. And the lunch actually took place almost a full year later, and our parents had us research everything on Buffett, learn everything about him. We built a scrapbook of his life for him, and we gifted it to him when we met him. And he actually, I think we were the first kids at the lunch, which was exciting. And my dad and Guy had us sit on either side of Buffett at the meal itself. So we were right next to him, and we had probably the best seats. And he gave us M&Ms with his face on them. We talked about very, and there's not an M&M saved. We consumed everything when we left the lunch. And I think my dad tried to save a couple, and we found them and ate them, just as kids would do. But yeah, we talked about a lot of various topics. I remember talking about Dakshina. I remember talking a little bit about investing, not too much, and a lot more about like how to live a good life, different things that mattered in his lifetime, kind of things like that. And the main biggest takeaway I still remember is he told my sister and I that the most important decision you'll make is who you marry, which is, I'm unmarried now, but I've definitely taken that to heart in my dating as a young woman, that he decided to give us that piece of advice.
No, it is a really important decision, and there's so much luck involved in it. So I can imagine that that is a really intimidating piece of advice to have in your head as you date and
Yes.
consider future partners.
Of course.
Yes. Well, I think that is just such a remarkable experience that you had. And I'm sure that it impacted you. Have you been able to stay in touch with Warren Buffett since that lunch or encounter him in person?
I haven't seen Buffett, but I think from the lunch, my dad developed more of a friendship with Munger. So I've seen him a lot since then, also just tagging along with my dad. But I actually haven't seen Buffett since that lunch.
Yeah, that's incredible. Well, let's see. So, going from having lunch with Warren Buffett at the age 12, at some point you end up at UC Berkeley. And I have in my notes that you started off as an economics major. I was also an economics major, but then the dismal science, as they call it. But then you switched to political science. Can you tell me a little bit about the thought process and changing your major?
Oh gosh. Yeah. So I think at Berkeley, and I think a lot of young people in college go through this where you expect one kind of major to be a certain way. I met the people, I saw the work, and the classes were exciting. I think the problems I didn't think were what economics would be. And I think I took a political science class for fun, and it was a lot more reading and writing, I think. And I was just a little bit more drawn to that. I liked the conversations that happened in class. Those classes were way more discussion based, and I just felt more engaged as a student. So I did make the switch. But before I made the switch, I tried statistics and computer science. So my transcript looks very weird for a political science major because I just tried everything. And end of the day, I really liked reading and writing. And I loved, and I think by this, my senior year in college, I was writing 40-page papers every few weeks for class, and I could really churn out a lot of material pretty fast. So I think that was a really fun skill set I picked up from political science.
Yeah, that's amazing. You could have gone to work on the sell side in the research in a research department somewhere.
Yes.
So, Monsoon, tell me, how would you describe your investment style?
Oh, yeah. I lean very heavy Munger. I'm not the cigar butt style at all. I actually have a very high disdain for them just because I think there's a reason they're valued that low. And so I love excellent businesses. The problem is so many of them just aren't cheap, or we have to really wait for them to be cheap. So the way I operate is like very little activity throughout the year. If something collapses in price or it's close to where I feel comfortable buying it, I buy it. But the PE I buy things at is probably higher than, where my dad would be buying it at. And the kind of the joke between my dad and I, and now Guy, is that I am not my dad's daughter. I'm Guy's daughter in a little bit my style. And I think now even Guy jokes that I'm also like his third daughter, except for like they'll poke fun at my portfolio and say, "You're my daughter, except for this name."
Oh.
So it's very fun. Yeah.
Well, it's a really special relationship, I will say, a special friendship that your father has with Guy Spier, and I
Yes.
assume a very special relationship that you have with Guy. It's so interesting. And will you explain for my listeners? I'm assuming that most of the listeners are very knowledgeable and understand what you mean when you say I'm more of a Munger type of investor, but just
Yeah.
explain that the difference between Ben Graham's cigar butts and Charlie Munger buying quality businesses.
Yeah, I think the best way to describe it is how Munger describes it. He says Ben Graham goes into a candy store and will just buy the cheapest thing he sees on the first day. And Munger would go into the candy store and find his very favorite piece of candy. And he'll come back each and every day and just check the price until it's a price he's comfortable at. And that's probably like very close to my style. There's probably 150, 200 businesses I love around the world, and most of them are just way too expensive to buy. So I just kind of sit waiting, reading more about business models, building that list out. And hopefully, when they collapse in price and I keep a close eye on them, that's probably when I would pull the trigger. And these are businesses I want to own for a very, very, very long time. And ideally, I don't want to sell. And I know that as a managing a fund, there will be redemptions, there will be reasons to sell, but I'm really hopeful that when I enter into a position, there would never be that reason to get rid of it.
I want to go back to a comment that you just made. I think in a joking way that Guy and your father will say, "Well, you're not my daughter because you have this position in your fund or in your account." How does that affect you? And would you ever change your opinion based on a recommendation from your dad or Guy? Or you're just a really independent thinker? How do you guard that facet of your investment philosophy?
There's so many like weeks and months of research that go into why I buy a name. I will always take criticism seriously, look at the name, think about it again. And I've talked to them about multiple names in my portfolio, and it's funny. There's a name I bought, which is the first name I bought in the fund, and I had told my dad about it. We were eating Korean soup tofu. He was tough on me on the price I paid for it. And his 13F just came out, and he bought the exact same name at the exact same price a year and a half later. And I came home for Thanksgiving, and I said, "Hey man, what's up
That's
with
really
that?" Yeah.
funny.
So I think all criticism I take seriously, Theirs doesn't have any extra impact because it's pretty casual. There's names in their portfolio I would get rid of if I was running them, and so I think it's just like a respect for each other's portfolio, but I do value their opinion and I take it seriously.
Yeah, I was just trying to think of the behavioral aspect behind that. It's so hard not to second guess yourself. And you know, some investment managers don't even talk about their positions because they don't want anyone to comment on the position and affect the way they think about it. So I was curious how that was handled between your dad and Guy. It sounds like it doesn't affect you. You listen to it, but you don't make decisions based off an opinion.
And they're very respectful of me too. I think when they bring it up, they're just kind and will give their reason. And, you know, I'll be like, yeah, that's a fair argument. It's probably something I've already thought about. And if I haven't, then I will take time to think about it and see what they're saying.
And do you do the same to them? Do you question
Yes.
them about their
Yes.
positions? Good for you.
Yes. Yes.
Yeah. So, how have you been influenced by your father most?
Two main things, no self-pity and no envy. And I think that actually came from the almanac, Charlie's almanac to him. And that's been two very big lessons that have helped in every single way of life. Investing, dating, taking rejection from jobs, taking rejection from boys and dealing with people. And it's just been, I think, the most valuable lesson I've gotten from him that's been helpful in every single way. It's helped me become confident, stay confident, and it's, I think, the most valuable thing I've learned that I would probably want to pass on the
Yeah,
most.
those are really great lessons for sure. So, your father and you are well known for attending the Berkshire Hathaway AGM. We saw you there this year, and you were so kind to be nice to my intern and invite him to come wait in line with you.
Of
How
course.
many Berkshire meetings have you attended?
So I started going 2013. If we count the pandemic years, it's 10. And if we don't count the pandemic years, it's actually 8. Yeah, and they're fun. I think I've been standing early in line. I think the first year I cut my friend around 5:30 a.m. And then every year after that, I just showed up with him early in line. And I think now he's in his mid-30s, so he comes maybe 15, 20 minutes after me now, but I think the youngest people should just be standing the longest and holding it out for us.
I agree with that. That is
Yes.
a great idea. I do not get in line at 5:30, and I'm happy to come in and kind of take whatever seat. And I have sat everywhere. There's really not a bad seat in the house. One year, my daughter and I sat behind the screen, and that was still a good seat. You could look down
Wow.
and see the top of Warren Buffett's head, but the screen was so big in front of you, and you know, you can definitely hear everything. So that worked as well. What are some important lessons or memories that you have from the Berkshire Hathaway AGMs?
Those are countless. And I actually think I take more away re-listening to the audio on Spotify than I actually do sitting there. And it's honestly because I'm just up really early in the morning and tired there. But I think what was most compelling is this year, more than any other year, he discussed kind of the importance of being kind, which he really hasn't covered any year before, which is very new. And what is he's 90 now, I think. And so I think more than any of the actual investment advice or the investment questions I get asked, you really are sitting there with two giants who have seen so much from, I mean, in investing, you get such a cool lens of the world and it's so broad, and you learn so much, and you have two people who are 90 and 98 kind of discussing it. And something that I took away the most this year was, you know, just be kind, which is very interesting. But yeah, I think that would be the most recent takeaway now. And my favorite part of every meeting is when he shows the Solomon clip every year, and just to like consistently remember mistakes that happen and to remember, you know, never forget what went
Yeah,
wrong. Yeah.
that's a good point. I'm a big believer in reminding yourself of the mistakes you've made. And I have a startup business and another startup business that I closed. And I have a picture framed that reminds me of the startup business I closed and why I closed it and all the mistakes I made. So it's still painful to look at, but it's important to remind yourself. Yeah. Well, tell me about your views on portfolio concentration, holding periods, et cetera. What does your portfolio look like? And I should say that you left UC Berkeley, you went to work at a fund, a well-known fund company, then you went to work for a startup after that, but now you've ended up launching your own investment company called Drew Investment Management. So before we get into portfolio construction, maybe walk me through your decision to launch your own investment company and the route you took to get there.
Yeah, so I think me doing my own thing was probably the biggest driver in me going to the startup, working on, I've always wanted to work on a small team. So even Dalton, I think the company at that time was 40, 45 people, which is pretty, that's the largest place I've ever worked, which with my peer group is not normal. They work at large companies and they do well. So I think just like having access to the CEO is really important to me. Learning from the main guy in charge has always been really, really important. So even at the startup I worked at, I was employee number 6. And I was the only business person, and it was 6 engineers. And we were building a little robot that painted your nails at home and made gel manicures. And I mean, you and I are both girls. I love getting my nails done. So that was just a fun product to work on. But yeah, I think for me, always being on a small team and learning from the entrepreneur was very important. And then just, I think, seeing both my parents as entrepreneurs was a heavy push. So I knew that I would do my own thing someday. I did not think I'd be running my own fund right now. And I think basically what happened was between Dalton and the startup, I didn't know, I think I was like 23, 24. I didn't know what I wanted to do. This was a huge piece of encouragement from my dad. He told me that he had met a industrial psychologist like 20 years ago who had given him like a 30-page write-up on who he is as a person and what his work environment should look like and whatnot. And he told me, like, you know, this would be a great time to kind of figure that out for yourself. So I went and I met this industrial psychologist and I went through his whole process. And what he basically told me was, I have to be in charge of my own thing. I just don't take direction well and I'm not really a big team player, which is sad to hear because I think I am, but I guess I'm not. But I actually have to do something that involves people, even though I don't like relying on them. And so just kind of like a lot of autonomy is really important. And I got that at the startup a little bit in that it was mostly me working on business things with one of the co-founders. And I got a lot of freedom there. But I really enjoy managing my own fund, raising capital the way I want, pursuing clients the way I want, and making investment decisions the way I see best fit. I'm like a confident person and confident in my ability. I have a great network of people, you know, including dad and guy to talk to with ideas. But I also, you know, I'm able to source ideas. I have good connections in India that I chat with and in Europe. So I think just the starting my own fund part, the main confidence piece came from when I left Dalton. After I had redeemed my money from the fund, I started the general partnership and just kind of created like a simple interactive broker's account, like a corporate account. And I had up until then did not have like a proper track record because any amount of cash I had from a bonus or like a random babysitting gig, I would just buy one name with that full piece and it would perform pretty well. But I had never gone through the process of here is like this much money and I'm going to allocate it across 5 or 10 names. So I went through that process end of 2019, all of 2020. And I think I did really well and I did better than my pay at the startup. So I actually left and just decided that, you know, this is what I do want to do. I think I can do this right. And there's people that are willing to give me a little bit of seed money to get started. So I just kind of decided to go for it.
Yeah, that's amazing. I say yeah. Go for it. What has been the most surprising thing about running your own business? What's been the most difficult, surprising aspect of running your own business?
I don't think anything has been, I think probably the most difficult part is I have a global mandate, but because I'm just kind of small in size, it's really difficult to get access to different countries. That's been the most frustrating because it just like doesn't seem to make sense to me. But in terms of raising from people and meeting potential limited partners and the amount that turn over to investing and the amount that just like stay in touch, I've been like pleasantly surprised. You know, we really like with the market down since I've launched, everyone has stuck by, nobody has redeemed. So that's been the most like positive, surprising thing that they really are, you know, supportive here for the long haul. And I think I have a good set of clients that understand the mission. And honestly, with that, I actually credit that to my dad and his marketing, just because most of them find me through him, and are just like very long-term thinkers. And I don't have people that are, you know, calling me every quarter asking me why something is a certain way and then asking to pull out. So I think I've been blessed with very good partners and more good partners coming in.
Well, that truly is a blessing. And it
Yes.
means you found the right partners. And I always remind people that, you know, it is a partnership between you and an investment manager. Even the top performing investment managers, if you as an investor can't control yourself and you're constantly redeeming or adding capital at the wrong times in and out, you're going to together produce a really bad return.
Yes.
And so that's wonderful that you have identified that at such an early stage in your career. I think that will be a big benefit to you as you continue. So congratulations on that.
Yes.
So speaking of your portfolio, what are your views on portfolio concentration? It sounds like you have a global mandate. How many positions do you have in your portfolio?
We're about six, seven names, almost seven full position names. We're currently at 40% cash. So, and we've been running for 1.75 years. So, really slow deployment. And I think that's probably what my investors like a lot is that I didn't just, you know, put it all to work right away. I think actually my old managers at Dalton think that's a mistake, but I just said, you know, these are like a lot of the bigger checks are from, you know, people I really love. And the majority of my investors are women. And so they're also just very patient people, you know, generally. And so I've just been deploying slowly and they've been noticing the cash going down slower and slower and they're all on board. But I think the goal for now is a 10 by 10, 10% for each name, no more than that at cost. And then ideally, you know, 8 to 12 names in the portfolio, just depending. But the goal is that like within the next few quarters, it's just 10 names, 10% each at cost.
Yeah, so very concentrated.
Very, yes.
And how are you diversified across geography?
We're about 20, 25% US, about 10% Europe, and then in Asia, that's pretty much the remaining amount. India, I'm about to get access to. It's been kind of tough. And so, since I mostly trained there for 2 years, that's the one I'm most excited about just because that'll probably be a straight 20, 25% allocation once we get access. And then hopefully cash is just down after then. But I think what I like about the global mandate really came from, I think, both Dalton and working at UCLA's endowment in my summers, because the way they divide their allocation is like US funds, international funds, and global funds. The first question I asked was, what's the difference between international and global? Because I thought they're the same. And they said
No.
international is like a Korean-only investor or a Brazil-only investor, whereas global is, you know, someone like Li Lu who's China, Korea, US. So it's not the whole world, it's just where he has his circle of competence and what he sees most fit. And I really liked that way of thinking about the world, that if I want to switch between three geographies or two geographies, I'm not limited in any way, but I also don't have to be in every geography.
Sure. John Templeton was very global in nature. He believed that you should move capital around the globe based on where you found the best opportunities. And actually, having the largest universe of stocks available to choose from is such an asset and will really allow you at different points in your career to avoid bubbles. So it's really great to have that flexibility. So I want to ask you about your experience in India. I mean, you have worked on an Indian fund at Dalton early in your career, and your family has this strong connection to India. You're very involved in your father's foundation, the Doc Shauna Foundation. Did I say that correctly?
Perfectly.
Will you please explain to my listeners the or describe the work of the Doc Shauna Foundation and your involvement there?
Yeah, so Doc Shauna basically wants to alleviate poverty, extreme poverty in India through education. And I think at first, the first idea before we had the model we have running now was, you know, identifying smart kids age 4 and then paying for their education all the way to college. And that quickly, I think that like very quickly did not work out because, you know, someone who's really bright at age 4 may not be bright at age 12 and then, you know, may not follow through. And so we switched, our dad really switched the model to when he learned about Super 30 and read the article on them. Basically, we take kids age 16 that are showing a lot of promise and come from extremely poor backgrounds, and we move them to 8 centers in India, and we take over every day of test prep for one test to get into IIT, the Indian Institute of Technology. Mm-hmm. And the acceptance rate to IIT is somewhere between like 1.5%, something really low. And in the beginning years of Dakshina, it was closer to 70% we're getting in. But as we've scaled, somewhere between 50 and 60% get into IIT on their first attempt, which is incredible. And the kids that don't get into IIT, they go to other phenomenal engineering schools in the country under another system called National Institute of Technology. And basically, these kids go through 2 years of training with us, 4 years of school in college that we actually don't pay for, but it doesn't cost much, and we partner with low interest rate loans for them. We have partners who offer that. And basically, within even their like first summer internship between their second and third year, their third and fourth year, they're able to get their family out of their current living situation. So you see a very fast return to the family. And then within like a year or two of working a good tech job, they're able to kind of just support their family ongoing and just change the entire situation. And so if they have younger siblings and stuff, they're now able to help them get prep, help them go to school and whatever they may want. And since we've added engineering, we've actually added medical, and that has way more women, and it's the same return. And medical school in India does not have, it's not as long as it is in the US. It's not pre-med and med school. It's just kind of straight med school.
Well, that is incredible. So have you spent a lot of time in India?
Yeah, I've been going to India once or twice a year since I was 13. So I used to be younger than the Dakshina scholars. Then I was their age. Then I was in college with some of them. And I've kind of grown up with a lot of them and we're friends on Facebook. And there's a couple in the US that I see relatively often. And my role right now in the foundation, I basically told my dad that the coolest thing you've ever done is Dakshina, and that, you know, when he passes, I want it, you know, I want to run the thing. And he said, okay, great, we'll bring you in. So that's like the one very nepotistic thing that we've done, which is, I think, okay, because we work together to do more good. So I'm the vice president of strategy, and Dakshina has too much money. And we're trying to figure out a way to run more education programs that also, you know, alleviate poverty or give more people more access to, you know, a better life in the future. So we were running a program with Khan Academy in 2 schools in India, one all boys school and one all girls school, ages or classes 5, 6, 7, 8. And it was to replace the math teacher in the school. And it was going pretty well, actually. The program ran great. There were some language barrier problems because Khan Academy is a little bit more word problem based than just straight math. But with COVID, we saw the most problems and we actually shut the program down. And we're looking at coding boot camps and various different things. So my role really is all new ventures. And there's an incredible team on the ground that runs the current program really well, actually.
Well, I look forward to receiving the annual report every year that your dad sends out. And I'm always impressed with the work of this organization. So it'll be interesting to see what you guys do in the future. Yeah. So going back to India as an opportunity set, it sounds like you want to access India. Yes. What do you see about the Indian market that attracts you?
Yeah. So I think compared to some other Asian countries, India has a very young average age. It's actually also the largest democracy in the world, which is good and bad for the country. Just has a lot of growth drivers that should be coming up, but it's an innovative country, and I think there's more companies on the public exchange in India than there is in the US. It's almost 5,000 in India. The problem with learning to invest in India is a lot of those businesses are family owned. Like 80% of the stock is owned by the family. And I think if you want training as a skeptical investor, India is a great place because there was a lot of fraud. There were businesses where the promoter group, which is the family, owns 80%. They don't pay a dividend, and the CEO pays himself like an annual salary of $10,000. So you just know that there has to be fraud there. There were companies that gave us lists of factories, and sometimes one of those factories wasn't there. And then there are businesses that had private and public listings and would just move assets between them and think that was totally normal, which is, you would never see that in the US with the regulation we have in place. But yeah, it's like the wild, wild west for investing.
So how do you protect yourself from that? If are you going
Oh.
to tap into this network you have in India, or do you
Yes.
foresee employing analysts maybe over in India that know the market really well?
So I went back and forth for 2 years, and then I spent basically 6 months straight in the country. And I was in Mumbai. I'd fly to some city every week, take a couple meetings, did a lot of conferences. I think I met over 300, maybe 400 management teams. And there's like six that are good businesses that are maybe not frauds. Yeah. And I think just while being there, I think this is really important for all emerging market investing because they don't have the same laws and protections that you have in the US. You really want to be good at like forensic financial accounting and like seeing what fraud kind of makes sense on the balance sheet and income statement. And you want a good network there to talk to where, you need to tell them, I'm looking at this name. Have you heard anything suspicious or anything with this name that might be fraudulent? And if anyone mentions anything, that would be like a pretty deep investigation, and I'd probably bring it up with more people. But anytime any investor would tell you, hey, this might be fraud, you just take it really seriously in India. And I think if I had done that entire experience sitting in LA, I would have been burned badly multiple times. Like, you really need to spend time on the ground there.
Yes, I think that's true of any emerging market. And of course, in the investment industry, if anybody even mentions the word fraud, I think you're under deep obligation to take it very seriously.
Yes.
Where are you currently finding investment opportunities? It sounds like you don't have a lot of turnover in your portfolio with a low number of positions right now, but where are you finding opportunities, or at least where are you looking?
I think my favorite exercise that I do every quarter, that I think anyone learning how to invest should still do every quarter, is when the 13Fs come out. If there's, any investor you like, if they've made a buy purchase, I love the exercise of figuring out why they bought it. And after that you run a valuation on it and see like, does this valuation make sense? Is this too high or not? And that's just kind of been my favorite exercise since I was probably like 19 or 20 years old. So that's been a great way to find the US names. In foreign countries, they disclose differently what the great investors are buying. And once you figure that out, that's another great thing to do with them. But yeah, I think most of my ideas come from talking to other value investors, reading a lot. I love newspapers and books. And if there's anything you kind of find interesting, I think the other really fun thing to study are recessions and what companies have done exceptionally well in recessions. And we are either very much in a recession right now or about to get into one right now. I think we're in it. And one of my favorite recession-proof ideas is the lipstick effect. And I think women understand this really well. The effect was basically coined by Leonard Lauder, the son of Estée Lauder. And he says that in times of recession, women stop buying, expensive bags and expensive purses and might start buying more luxury but smaller ticket items such as like a lipstick or a perfume. And so you see, and I remember looking at, if you look at LVMH in 07, 08, 09, 2010, and different recession periods, their selective retailing section, really took off. And they own Sephora in that selective retailing section. And all my girlfriends, anytime they walk into Sephora, it's like they black out and spend $200 or $400 and don't even realize what they bought. So I think the other really fun thing is just to study like what did well in recessions, why did it do well? Do we want to kind of like look at something like that to put in the portfolio to really help it survive these like tougher times?
Yes, well, your girlfriends and my daughters. So when they go into Sephora or Ulta, I really need to get them out of there very
Very
quickly
fast, yeah.
because they put a lot of tiny little things in my basket, and somehow those tiny little things add up to a huge amount of money. So,
Yes.
very dangerous territory for my children. Well, tell me, do you have any hobbies outside of investing? I know that you hike a lot. I'm so envious when I see pictures from your trips. And I think I just saw, or sometime in the past few years, I've seen a picture of you in Peru. And I'm envious of all of these adventures you go on. I'm waiting for my invitation for you to invite me. But tell me about your hobbies outside of investing.
I have a girlfriend who loves hiking, and I basically never say no to her. And so she and I really love kind of planning these 8 to 12 person trips. We did Patagonia, we did an Iceland road trip, and then it got a lot more intense where we summited Mount Kilimanjaro. And there's this quote by John Muir that says, "The mountains are calling, and I must go." And it's, I think once you do one mountain, you kind of want to do them all. My mom and dad in the beginning hated that I would just like, fly to a foreign country and climb a mountain for like 9 days and just would have no internet connection or anything. And now they're kind of used to it and are excited about it and are proud of it. And yeah, I just did Machu Picchu, the Inca Trail. That was probably my favorite because it's the shortest and it's the most historical one I've been on. And I think the next on my list is either like the Tour de Mont Blanc, which is like a 14 or 21 day hike, or doing like the Dolomites in Europe. And then I will probably never do the Himalayas because it's so unsafe, but there's another very pretty trek in Nepal called Annapurna, which is at the foothills of the Himalayas, and you stay in tea house lodges and have lentils and rice every day. So that's like another exciting one. But I love hiking. I have tried to avoid shopping as much as I can, but that's definitely another fun thing that I like to do. And I think other than that, my other hobbies include like audiobooks, reading, and I live in New York City right now, and I have a lot of friends in the city who all moved here in the pandemic to just stop living at home. And so I have a good time in New York.
Well, that's great. When you go to Nepal, you will have to invite me to go with you.
I will bring
I
you, yes.
am. My grandmother was a mountain climber, and she did a great job climbing and climbed all over. And so I have this little facet of my personality where I love books on mountain climbing. I also love to hike. I watch any movie or documentary on mountain climbing. I just watched one on Netflix called Aftershock, which was about an earthquake and avalanche that hit Nepal. I think it was in 2015.
Wow.
But I would certainly love to go there and see that. What are your favorite books? What books do you recommend? It looks like you have a lot of them on your website. And
Yes.
I know you just sent me, I believe, A Random Walk Down Wall Street, which it's been many years since I've read that book, but I look forward to reconnecting with that over the holidays. What are
Of
your other
course.
favorite books?
The one book I really liked reading, I think last holiday season was Trend Watching by Ron Insana. And I actually wanted to mail that book out, but it's out of print. And there's only a couple used copies on Amazon. And that one really talks about just like the bubbles and what causes bubbles. And it's kind of fun. It starts with the tulip bubble, which is the most famous in the 1600s. And it goes, I think the book covers a lot of fun facts. Like when anytime basically innovation comes up, like railroads or cars, or even when they had canals, the whole world goes, or a portion of the world goes crazy excited about what this can bring. They talk about it, making trade easier and like leveling the playing field and being more democratic. And these are themes that are popular today with another style of investing that all my friends from Berkeley are involved in. And it just talks about, I think like it said, when canals became a thing, there were 130 public companies listed on the New York Stock Exchange for canal companies. And so just kind of talks about what causes mayhem and chaos and what they promise. And like, without it, for sure, greatness comes, but we have no idea which player is going to be the one that really comes out on top. And it's truly is luck. And what I think is more in line with reality is that none of the initial players will get it right. And someone a little bit later down the road will get it correct. So I think that book last winter was really exciting. And my favorite nonfiction book of all time is In Cold Blood by Truman Capote. I mean, it's just investigative journalism. It's probably one of the best pieces written. There's so many famous sentences from it in literature today. It's probably like my all-time favorite nonfiction book.
Well, that's great. And I assume that you're talking about crypto.
Yes.
When you're referencing that.
Yeah.
We've actually been short crypto since last January. So that awesome. Paid off very handsomely for us. And we did that using an ETF, but very, very skeptical of that. Early in my career, I met with John Templeton, my uncle, and I graduated from college in 98. It was the big dot-com bubble. And I went to visit him in the Bahamas and ask him what dot-com stocks he was buying. And he very patiently walked me through all the bubbles he'd seen in his lifetime. And he had analyzed them all and said, you know, the time to get out of those stocks was, you know, 6 months or a year prior. And he would have, you know, certainly avoided dot-com stocks. I mean, he was short the NASDAQ back then. Yeah. And he, I feel certain, would also have avoided crypto as well.
Of course.
Yeah. So certainly yes. Interesting time, everything we're seeing in the markets. From your years of experience, what is the single most important lesson you've learned regarding investing?
Oh, you have to be the hardest on your ideas more than anyone else. Mm-hmm. So when you make a thesis of what's going to go right, you need to destroy it and take it apart. And it won't fully withstand, but if it can withstand the majority of it, that's pretty good. So actually, when I was really interested in investing at like 19 or 20, and I told my dad, we ran a caliper test on myself to see where I would, how I would be basically as a portfolio manager. And I came incredibly high on skepticism, just very naturally skeptical. And I think that's probably been my greatest asset and has helped me the most to just really, really, really doubt ideas I'm putting forward and really try them against different scenarios. So I think that's been really helpful. And then the other thing is, anytime you learn a business model, the more you learn, whether you invested or not, and you just like keep building model on model, they will overlap in such elegant ways that you wouldn't have seen when you first started. And I'm just mostly really excited to see how the models I continue to learn kind of interact with each other. And I think that's another good one.
Yeah, I agree. What is your best advice to young people?
I think if young people in college, I actually gave this advice to our shared connection, Maya.
Oh, yeah.
Peterson. At Berkeley, we had 1 month winter breaks and 14-week summer breaks. And those 4 weeks in the winter, that's a great internship opportunity for something you really want to try. So I actually had double the internships of all my friends when I graduated because I had used my winter breaks to go work for different people and learn different things. So that's probably one piece of advice, is use every break you have that's significant to really build work experience in varying categories, just to see what works for you. And then this one actually comes from a conversation with Guy on a mail campaign. So I really wanted to work at a hedge fund out of college. And I told my dad, he said, no problem, we can email people. And I said, no, like the last name is more than enough. I really want to kind of just like try this out on my own, just contact people and see if they want to interview me. Mm-hmm. And he just said, you know, can I get involved in the process of how you apply? And I said, sure. And so what we put together, I've given the same framework to at least like 80 people that have messaged me on LinkedIn asking for, how did you work at a hedge fund out of college? I wrote a stock pitch on Dillard's because I saw Greenlight buy it in 2015, 2016. This is before Ted Weschler bought it in the more recent dip. And I mailed it in the mail to 750 hedge funds in the US. And I got 8 interviews and 2 job offers. And I think 90% of the people didn't respond to me, but 10% did. So 1% interviewed, but the 10% that replied are in my network, are, you know, connected with me on LinkedIn. I had a coffee chat or something with. And so I think something I'm a big fan of and would recommend to anyone young is you have energy and you have time. So you should really hustle and try as many things as possible.
Yeah, you know, this is very similar. When I read that you said this in another interview, and when I was starting out in the industry, I did not know, I didn't have a specific idea like you did. Like, I didn't know I wanted to go work for a hedge fund, but I knew I was interested in investing in finance and that I just wanted a job in the industry. And so I took the same approach. I took my college alma mater list and focused on the city I was living in and sent a letter to every single alum there. And then I did the same thing with my high school. So I was just mailing out resumes and letters. And, you know, you hear back from a very small percentage, and then from that percentage have a smaller percentage of interviews, which are usually informational interviews. They're not even real interviews. But I really encourage young people to follow a similar strategy. I mean, it is a numbers game. And I also often tell people not to be so obsessed with finding the best fit and your passion. You know, to me, it's more important to figure out really early on what you're not good at, what you don't want to do, to try a lot of things. I think there are many opportunities out there for young people. So I share some similar advice to young people in that regard too. Well, is there anything else that we should know about you? How can my listeners follow your career and what you're doing?
Probably the best way is Twitter. I don't post too frequently, but I post sometimes. I'm probably just busy audiobooking and reading. And then I post my reading list in, I think, the most creative way online on my website. So my dad's fund page has his bookshelf on like this Word document with links. And I kind of just wanted to freshen it up with my pick. So I put like the hardcover so you can see the photo of the book, and it goes straight to Amazon if you want to buy it. So I think, yeah, just staying up to date with my Twitter. And if you need books to read, I have a couple on my website that I think are really interesting.
Well, wonderful. I look forward to following your career. You're always a bright, shining face at these conferences I go to. I love to connect with you. I love to see the relationship you have with your father. And I appreciate all the time you've spent with me today. I look forward to following your career for many years and hopefully maintaining this friendship and having you back on the podcast in the future.
Of course. Thank you, Lauren.
Yeah, thank you so much. Thank you for listening to Investing the Templeton Way. Please be sure to subscribe on your favorite podcast player. To view the show notes and resources mentioned in today's show, head to investingthetempletonway.com.